Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Calamity Howler right after this. You know, Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history, and surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity from bank deposits to medical visits has produced greater efficiency and security, all right, but it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. Now, the federal government currently maintains an average of about 15 files on every American, according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget. And closer to home, state and local governments use computers to keep their own files on us, and a study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that that state, New York, and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems containing 10,799 categories of information on New York residents, and every one of those systems contained between 2 and 10 million records. And all of this information about you is gained from 63 sources, and this information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how the government, banking, insurance, business, and industry obtains all of this information about you? What are their sources, and how is it stored? How is it retrieved? What do they want it for? How do they use it? Well, knowing how this information is gathered and what information is stored and what information you want to keep personal and private actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, for more information about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967 and ask for my free general law CD package, and let me tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and private as you want to be. It's educational, it's informative, entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge. You can call and order direct 417-273-4967, or if you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send me your email request. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Tonight's report from the Calamity Howler, published by A.V. Krebs. If you'd like to subscribe, it's free of charge. All you have to do is send an email and ask for a subscription to the Calamity Howler. A.V. Krebs at earthlink.net. It's easy enough. It's A-V-K-R-E-B-S at earthlink.net. Now, Krebs puts it out free, but he asks for voluntary contributions. In addition to the Calamity Howler, you'll also receive, I guess if you ask for it, the Agribusiness Examiner, a newsletter. One's a political, the other is an agricultural newsletter. Two newsletters, 104 issues a year. He's probably the best that there is on agribusiness. When it comes to agriculture, well, I wouldn't say he's the best. Maybe he's second best next to Acres USA, but, you know, he's right up there with Acres and A.V. Krebs. And it's free of charge. Just send him a contribution. I suggest $25 a month. That's $300 a year for two newsletters. It's about 17 cents a page. 17 cents a page, and it's that's about 17 pages each one. All right, on the Calamity Howler, the first article, Democrats and Liberals Creating Their Own Nightmare. As a nation, we're currently enmeshed in a war that President George W. Bush not only instigated, but continues to support and pursue, while his Democratic opponent proclaims that it is the wrong war, in the wrong place at the wrong time, and yet believes that we need to continue to invest more troops and resources in the fight. Meanwhile, the mainstream media, which, and with precious few exceptions, refuses to confront the electorate with the enormous human, security, economic, and social costs of an unwinnable war, not only as those costs impact the coalition, but also the world as well. Now, recently, the Institute for Policy Studies and the Foreign Policy in Focus issued a September 30th report. It's called A Failed Transition, on those costs as of September the 24th. Now, while Democrats and liberals continue to loudly denounce Bush's war, they support their own hawkish candidate, and in the words of independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader, they go about creating their own nightmare as they demonstrate that they have no breaking point. By showing they have no breaking point, traditional Democrats and liberals demean not only their traditional values and base as a party of the people, but they allow themselves to be taken both for granted and dismissed by their candidate. With no real policy voice, they also see John Kerry and the Democratic National Committee and its cohorts not only continue to exploit the myth as voters, they have no other alternative but to support Kerry. But by accepting that myth, these same liberals and Democrats allow their candidate, in a shameless pursuit of politically illiterate voters, to position himself closer and closer to a position that the present war is winnable, if only by simply waging a more efficiently managed war. Not only is this a classic example, a classic case of the morally repugnant end justifying the means, but it is destined to take us down a far more dangerous path than the one that led to the Vietnam tragedy, whereby we will both place our own national security in constant peril, but single-handedly we will be disastrously destabilizing the world's geopolitical framework for generations to come. Now, the costs of the Iraq War, put out by the Institute for Policy Studies and Foreign Policy in Focus, reprinted from the Undernews Mail 2. Here are some of the key findings from the Institute for Policy Studies. First of all, the U.S. military casualties have been highest during this transition. U.S. military casualties, wounded and killed, stand at a monthly average of 747 since the transition to Iraqi rule on June 28, 2004. Now, this contrasts with a monthly average of 482 U.S. military casualties, that's killed and injured, during the invasion, March 20th through May 1st of 2003, and a monthly average of 415 during the occupation, May 2nd through June 28th, 2004. So we have gone from 415 casualties to about 747. Now that's per month. Second, the Institute for Policy Studies notes that non-Iraqi contractor deaths have also been highest during this transition period. There's also been a huge increase in the average monthly deaths of U.S. and other non-Iraqi contractors since the transition. On average, 18 contractors have died each month since the June 28th transition versus 7 contractor deaths per month during the previous 14 months of occupation. Third, the estimated strength of Iraqi resistance is and has been skyrocketing because the U.S. military occupation remains in place. The transition has failed to win Iraqi support or diminish Iraqi resistance to the occupation. According to Pentagon estimates, the number of Iraqi resistance fighters has quadrupled between November of 2003 and September of 2004. It's quadrupled from about 5,000 to more than 20,000 today. The deputy commander of coalition forces in Iraq, that's British Major General Andrew Graham, indicated to Time magazine in early September that he thinks the 20,000 estimate is far too low. He estimates Iraqi resistance strength in excess of 50,000, and this rise is even starker when juxtaposed to the Brookings Institute estimates that an additional 25,000 Iraqi resistance fighters have been detained or killed between May of 2003 and August of 2004. And fourth, the U.S.-led coalition shrinks further and further after the transition. The number of countries identified as members of the coalition backing the United States-led war started with 30 on March 28, 2003. So we had 30 other countries on our side, on our team, called the coalition. Then grew in the early months of the war. So we had 30, and there were a few more that joined us. Since then, 8 countries have withdrawn their troops, and Costa Rica has demanded to be taken off of the coalition list. At the war's beginning, coalition countries represented about 19% of the world's population. Today, the remaining countries with forces in Iraq represent about 13% of the world's population. And the U.S. military deaths between the start of the war on March 19, 2003, through September the 22nd, 2004, a period of about 16 months, 1,175 coalition troops have been killed, including 1,040 U.S. military. And of the total, 925 were killed after President Bush declared the end of combat operations on May 1st, 2003. Over 7,413 U.S. troops have been wounded since the war began. That's 6,953 up to 7,413 since May 1st of 2003. Now, there are some journalists that have been killed as well as some contractors. As of September the 22nd, 2004, there's been 154 civilian contractors, missionaries, and civilian worker deaths since May 1st of 2004, and of these, 52 have been identified as Americans. Now, journalists have been killed. 44 international media workers have been killed in Iraq as of September the 22nd, 2004, including 33 since President Bush declared the end of combat operations. Eight of the dead worked for U.S. companies. Then there are the security costs. The terrorist recruitment and action, according to the London-based International Institute for Strategic Studies, Al-Qaeda's membership is now at 18,000, with 1,000 active Al-Qaeda members in Iraq. The State Department's 2003 Patterns of Global Terrorism documented 625 deaths, 3,646 injuries due to terrorist attacks in 2003. The report acknowledged that significant incidents increased from 60% of the total attacks in 2002 to 84% in 2003. So it's up from 60 to 84%. Now, these are called significant attacks. Low U.S. credibility. The polls reveal that the war has damaged the United States government's standing and credibility in the entire world. Surveys in eight European and Arab countries demonstrated broad public agreement that the war has hurt rather than helped the war on terrorism. At home, 52% of Americans polled by the Annenberg Election Survey disapprove of President Bush's handling of Iraq. Military mistakes. A number of former military officers have criticized the war, including retired Marine General Anthony Zinni, who has charged that by manufacturing a false rationale for war, abandoning traditional allies, propping up and trusting Iraqi exiles, and failing to plan for post-war Iraq, the Bush administration made the United States less secure, not more secure. Now that's retired Marine General Anthony Zinni. Low troop morale and lack of equipment. As of March 2004, an Army survey found 52% of soldiers reporting low morale and three-fourths reporting they were poorly led by their officers. Lack of equipment has been an ongoing problem. The Army did not fully equip soldiers with bulletproof vests until June of 2004, forcing many families to purchase these bulletproof vests out of their own pockets and then send them to their sons and daughters in Iraq. Loss of first responders. Our National Guard troops make up almost one-third of the U.S. Army troops now in Iraq. Their deployment puts a particularly heavy burden on their home communities because they are first responders, including police, firefighters, and emergency medical personnel. For example, 44% of the country's police forces have lost officers to Iraq, and in some states, the absence of so many Guard troops has raised concerns about the ability to handle natural disasters, and the use of private contractors. There's an estimated 20,000 private contractors that are carrying out work in Iraq, traditionally done by the military. Despite the fact that they often lack sufficient training and are not accountable to the same guidelines and reviews as our military personnel. Then there are the economic costs. The bill so far, Congress has approved $151.1 billion for Iraq. Congressional leaders anticipate an additional supplemental appropriation of at least $60 billion after the election. Then the long-term impact on the U.S. economy, economist Doug Henwood has estimated that the war bill will add up to an average of at least $3,415 for every U.S. household. Oil prices. U.S. crude oil prices are now over $50 a barrel. As of August the 19th, they were approaching 50 at $48 a barrel, the highest level since 1983. It's a development that most analysts attribute, at least in part, to the deteriorating situation in Iraq. Economic impact on the military families. Since the beginning of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, 364,000 reserve troops and National Guard soldiers have been called for military service, serving tours of duty that often last 20 months. Studies show that between 30 and 40% of reservists and National Guard members earn a lower salary when they leave civilian employment for military deployment. Army Emergency Relief has reported that requests from military families for food stamps and subsidized meals increased several hundred percent between 2002 and 2003. And there are social costs, U.S. budget and social programs. The Bush administration's combination of massive spending on the war and tax cuts for the wealthy means less money for social spending. The $151 billion expenditure for the war through this year could have paid for, in close to 23 million housing vouchers, health care for over 27 million uninsured Americans, salaries for nearly 3 million elementary school teachers, 678,000 new fire engines, over 20 million Head Start slots for children, or health care coverage for 82 million children. A leaked memo from the White House to domestic agencies outlines major cuts following the election, including funding for education, Head Start, home ownership, job training, medical research, and homeland security. Then there are the social costs to the military. In order to meet troop requirements in Iraq, the Army has extended the tours of duty for soldiers. These extensions of their tour of duty has been particularly difficult for reservists. Many of these reservists never expected to face such long separation from their jobs or their families, and according to military policy, reservists are not supposed to be on assignment for more than 12 months every 5 to 6 years. Well, to date, the average tour of duty for all soldiers in the Iraq conflict has been 320 days. And a recent Army survey revealed that more than half of the soldiers said that they would not re-enlist. Now, the costs to the veteran health care system, about 64% of the more than 7,000 U.S. soldiers injured in Iraq received wounds that prevented them from returning to duty. Now, one trend has been an increase in amputees, the result of improved body armor and protected vital organs, but not the extremities. So, as in previous wars, many soldiers are likely to have received ailments that will not be detected for many years yet to come. And yet, the Veterans Administration healthcare system is not prepared for the swelling numbers of claims. Now, in May, the House of Representatives approved funding for fiscal year 2005 that is $2.6 billion less than needed, according to many veterans groups. Mental health costs. The New England Journal of Medicine reported in July of 2004 that one in six soldiers returning from war in Iraq showed signs of post-traumatic stress disorder, major depression, or severe anxiety. And only 23 to 40% of respondents in the study who showed signs of mental disorder had sought any mental health care. Now, there are human costs as well, and the Iraqi deaths and injuries as of September the 22nd, 2004, between 12,800 and 14,800 Iraqi civilians have been killed as a result of the U.S. invasion and ensuing occupation. And while an estimated 40,000 Iraqis may have been injured during major combat operations, between 5,000 and 6,500 Iraqi soldiers and insurgents were killed. And then there are the effects of the depleted uranium. The health impacts of the use of depleted uranium weaponry in Iraq are yet to be known. You see, the Pentagon estimates that U.S. and British forces used 1,100 to 2,200 tons of weaponry made from the toxic and radioactive metal during the March 2003 bombing campaign. And many scientists blame the far smaller amount of depleted uranium weapons. Blame for the smaller amount of DU weapons used in the Persian Gulf War for illnesses among U.S. soldiers, as well as a sevenfold increase in childbirth defects in Basra in southern Iraq. I've reported on depleted uranium a number of times, and there are many websites that tell of the hazards, and yet, so far as I know, the military has never acknowledged that there is a problem with depleted uranium. I've never heard Dan Rather or anybody talk about it in the mainstream press. I've reported on it a number of times. And it's probably the number one cause of the Gulf War syndrome from the 91 war, and probably the many of the illnesses and problems suffered by Gulf War veterans this time. Then there's a rise in crime. Murder, rape, and kidnapping have skyrocketed since March of 2003, forcing Iraqi children to stay home from school and women to stay off the streets at night. Violent deaths rose from an average of 14 per month in 2002 to 357 per month in 2003. So there's a psychological impact. Living under occupation without the most basic security has devastated the Iraqi population. And a poll conducted by the Iraq Center for Research and Strategic Studies in June of 2004 found that 80% of Iraqis believe that coalition forces should leave either immediately or directly after the election. All right, then there are some economic costs. Unemployment. Iraqi joblessness doubled from 30% before the war to 60% in the summer of 2003. While the Bush administration now claims that unemployment has dropped, the U.S. is only employing about 120,000 Iraqis out of a workforce of 7 million in reconstruction projects. Corporate war profiteering goes on in Iraq. Most of Iraq's reconstruction has been contracted out to U.S. companies rather than experienced Iraqi firms. And top contractor Halliburton is being investigated for charging $160 million for meals that were never served to troops and $61 million in cost overruns on fuel deliveries. Halliburton employees also took $6 million in kickbacks from subcontractors, while other employees have reported extensive waste, including the abandonment of $85,000 trucks because they had flat tires. Iraq's oil economy. Anti-occupation violence has prevented Iraq from capitalizing on its oil assets, and there have been an estimated 118 attacks on Iraq's oil infrastructure since June of 2003. By September of 2004, oil production still had not reached pre-war levels, and major attacks caused oil exports to plummet to a 10-month low in August of 2004. Now, keep in mind that Iraq has about 25% of the known or proven oil reserves in the world. So Iraqi oil is pretty important to take up the slack in oil production now that we have just about reached peak oil. Notice prices are over $50 a barrel, and China is in there buying up all the oil that they can get their hands on. Well, hang on, we'll be back with more on the Calamity Howler when we return right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School direct at 1-417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org. The Law Hour, an editorial review, brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events from the scriptural perspective 7 days a week. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are believed to be true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to the authors and publications used on this program and often endorses and recommends books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean necessarily that the authors or the publishers that we recommend or endorse will reciprocate by endorsing the Law Hour or editorial review. Most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans who do not necessarily endorse the opinions or beliefs expressed here on the Law Hour and editorial review. All right, we're talking about the Calamity Howler, H-O-W-L-E-R. It's a political newsletter published by A.V. Krebs. It's spelled A-V-K-R-E-B-S at earthlink.net, earthlink.net, N-E-T. And you can order a free subscription to the Calamity Howler by simply sending your name and address to A.V. Krebs at earthlink.net. Now, this comes over the Internet on your email, as does the Agricultural Examiner. And he puts these out free. He said he doesn't turn anybody down, and as far as I know, that's true. But he does ask for voluntary contributions to help him put out these two newsletters. It's a little different. Most newsletters charge a subscription price, like the Privateer is $180 a year Australian. The Money Changer, I don't know what the price of that is, probably $150 a year, something like that. But A.V. Krebs puts this out free and relies upon those, I guess, that can afford to support it. So whether you send him $5 a month or $25, now I just picked a number, I think they're worth $25 a month. There's two newsletters. That's $150 each per year. That's about what newsletters go for, $150. You get two of them. They're 17 pages. They come out weekly. That's 52 a year. Most newsletters do not come out weekly. I want to point that out. For instance, the Money Changer is monthly, and the Privateer is bi-monthly. So you get 25 issues of the Privateer. That's about 180 Australian, 130 American. I think the Money Changer is 150. That's 12 issues. And here's the Agricultural Examiner and the Calamity Howler. The Calamity Howler now is a political newsletter, and the Agricultural Examiner is an agriculture or farming newsletter. Just like Acres USA is a farmer publication or a farm publication, I recommend it to all of you, whether you live in the city, in the country, in the suburbs. And keep in mind that he puts out twice as many newsletters or twice as many publications, and puts them out free. It's a heck of a service, I think, to the American people, and I certainly appreciate the Calamity Howler and the Agricultural Examiner. Keeping in mind now that I do not necessarily endorse the editorial opinions or political ideologies that are espoused by A.V. Krebs or anybody else, either religious, economic, or so on. But the information that's contained in there is good information. Take a look here at the social costs of the war in Iraq. The health infrastructure, after more than a decade of crippling sanctions, Iraq's health facilities were further damaged during the war and post-invasion looting. Iraq's hospitals continue to suffer from a lack of supplies and an overwhelming number of patients. Education has been impacted. UNICEF estimates that more than 200 schools were destroyed in the conflict and thousands more were looted in the chaos following the fall of Saddam Hussein. The environment has been damaged. The U.S.-led attack damaged water and sewer systems and the country's fragile desert ecosystem, and it also resulted in oil well fires that spewed smoke across the country and left unexploded ordnance that continues to endanger the Iraqi people and environment. Mines and unexploded ordnance cause an estimated 20 casualties per month in Iraq. Then there are the human rights costs. Even with Saddam Hussein overthrown, Iraqis continue to face human rights violations from the occupying forces, as shown at Abu Ghraib prison. In addition, the widely publicized humiliation and torture of prisoner abuse has been widespread throughout the post-9/11 military operations, with over 300 allegations of abuse in Afghanistan, Iraq, and at Guantanamo Bay. As of mid-August 2004, only 155 investigations into the existing 300 allegations have been completed. Sovereignty costs. Despite the proclaimed transfer of sovereignty to Iraq, the country continues to be occupied by U.S. and coalition forces and has severely limited political and economic independence. The interim government does not have the authority to reverse the nearly 100 orders by former CPA head Paul Bremer that, among other things, allows for privatization of Iraq's state-owned enterprises and profit preferences for domestic firms in reconstruction. Then there are costs to the entire world. The human costs. While Americans make up the vast majority of military and contractor personnel in Iraq, other U.S. allied coalition troops have suffered 135 war casualties in Iraq. In addition, the focus on Iraq has diverted international resources and attention away from humanitarian crises, such as in the Sudan. Then there are disabling international laws. The unilateral U.S. decision to go to war in Iraq violated the United Nations Charter, setting a dangerous precedent for other countries to seize any opportunity to respond militarily to any claimed threats, whether real or contrived, that must be preempted. The U.S. military has also violated the Geneva Convention, making it more likely that in the future, other nations will ignore these protections in their treatment of civilian populations and detainees. Undermining the United Nations. At every turn, the Bush administration has attacked the legitimacy and the credibility of the United Nations, undermining the institution's capacity to act in the future as the centerpiece of global disarmament and conflict resolution. The efforts of the Bush administration to gain UN acceptance of an Iraqi government that was not elected but rather installed by occupying forces undermines the entire notion of national sovereignty as the basis for the UN Charter. It was on this basis that Secretary General Kofi Annan referred specifically to the vantage point of the UN Charter in his September 2004 finding that the war was illegal. Well, from a conservative point of view, the United Nations was a bad idea for America anyway, at least in my view and in the view of many Americans. Not the majority by any means, but at least by many of us. And as a result of that, I'm not particularly bummed out that America has a go-it-alone unilateral policy in Iraq. But I wanted to point out to you that in Afghanistan, the fellow that was running for president, backed by the United States, in fact, the guy that was installed, his name is Karzai, was a member of the board of directors of Union Oil Company of California. Union Oil Company director was installed as the premier or prime minister of Afghanistan. During the recent elections, the United States ponied up money and gave 75% of the election campaign funds to Karzai and 20% to the other 17 candidates. Now, that sounds like to me that the United States was biased in favor of their hand-picked puppet, Karzai, and gave him the money to go out and campaign and get elected. Now, we got the same thing going on in Iraq. Now, I'm not criticizing the Bush administration for putting in these puppet governments, but I think that we should be honest about it. Because these puppet governments are being installed by United States political interests for long-term United States political objectives. And we're buying and paying for these wars, and therefore I think we ought to buy and pay for the politicians in these countries and put them into power, and we expect them, just like the Roman Empire of old, put in a Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, just like Paul Bremer was our American governor, and then we want to give local home rule to the Jews, like the Romans did, by putting in our own puppet. And we want to use one of their guys, and so we've installed a Iraqi to run the interim Iraqi government. And just like the Romans did with the Jews, installing Herod, a local Jew, to run the local Palestinian Jewish government at the time of Christ the Messiah. I mean, you know, politics doesn't change, times change, but politics doesn't. So the American Empire installing these puppet governments for our own political interests is fine with me because I'm an American. Now, of course, if you're an Afghani, that's another story, and if you're an Iraqi or a Muslim or something, you probably see something wrong with that. And after all, as an American, I don't see anything wrong with going to Iraq and stealing their oil. Boy, I would really be bummed out if the Iraqis came over to Texas and stole our oil. But, you know, if you're practicing from each according to his ability and to each according to his need, we Americans have a great need for oil, and you Iraqis have a great amount of oil to satisfy our needs. And we are, after all, practicing communists. Now, there was a time when Americans believed in the golden rule, that is, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. And since we wouldn't have you Iraqis coming over to America and stealing our oil in Texas or Louisiana, we have never gone over to Iraq to steal your oil, well, until recently. But once we adopted communism here in the United States, you know, the sky is the limit. At least that's what it appears to me. How does it appear to you? Now, faced with opposition in the United Nations Security Council, the United States government attempted to create the illusion of multilateral support for the war by pressuring other governments to join a so-called coalition of the willing. This not only circumvented UN authority, but also undermined democracy in many coalition countries, where public opposition to the war has been as high as 90%. And as of the middle of September, only 29 members of the Coalition of the Willing had forces in Iraq, in addition to the United States. These countries, combined with the United States, make up less than 14% of the world's population. I mentioned that a little earlier. Now, I want to point out for President Bush's benefit over here that if we compared President Bush and his conduct of the war with Abraham Lincoln and his conduct of the war, halfway through the war, we would have all concluded that President Lincoln was involved in the wrong war in the wrong place at the wrong time, squandering assets, didn't have a plan, didn't know what he was doing, and couldn't win it, and it's an unwinnable war, especially out around Gettysburg time. Now, when the war concluded and the North won, well, then Lincoln was vindicated, and he was a great political leader, a great military leader, a great champion. You know, to the winner goes the spoils, doesn't it? And so our history tells us about all the greatness of President Lincoln. Now, it's premature to criticize George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and their conduct of the war in Iraq. The war is on, the war is raging, and this is the equivalent of 1863. We don't have a final determination yet. So I wouldn't want to criticize President Roosevelt, you know, in 1943, saying, gee, you've been at this for 2 years. It's indecisive. It looks like it's unwinnable. The Nazis are going to win the war, and the Japanese are too powerful, and we ought to sue for peace and give up. Well, as time progressed along, we got the upper hand, and we finally won the war. And I would suspect that if you leave President Bush alone, he'll go ahead and he'll win the war. Now, your opposing forces on the other side cannot defeat the United States militarily, but they can defeat us psychologically. And if they're successful in their battle to defeat us psychologically, well, then we will be defeated militarily because we're going to give up and quit. Now, of course, that's yet to be decided. We don't know how that's going to work out yet, do we? Now, the cost to the global economy, the $151 billion spent by the U.S. government on this war, could have cut world hunger in half and covered HIV/AIDS medicine, childhood immunization, and clean water and sanitation needs of the developing world for more than 2 years. As a factor in the oil price hike, the war has created concerns of a return. This is a return to the shortages and stagflation of the 1970s, and already the world's major airlines are experiencing an increase in costs of $1 billion or more per month. $1 million a month. Now, I'm not here to say that President Bush is the cause of this or the fault. You know, American foreign policy toward Israel is the root cause of the Muslim dissatisfaction. And prior to Israel's formation in 1948, we had pretty good relations with the Arabs. And after 1948, and our support of Israel, it got worse and worse. And we have a decidedly one-sided policy against the Arabs in favor of Israel. I mean, that's just where life's at. It's where reality exists. So the bottom line then, bottom line, is that the Arabs are taking their revenge upon Satan America, the guy, the country that they see as being the great Satan. And they're religious people, and religious people get after it. And they're willing to blow themselves up and kill themselves. And that's especially dangerous, taking on an adversary who has a morally righteous indignation against imagined or real wrongs that have been committed against them. They are going to be a tough nut to crack, even if they're wrong. Hang on a minute. Let me give you a message, and I'll be right back. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Hey, are you concerned about your privacy? And how much does your government know about you anyway? And how much do you want your government to know about you? Well, government only knows as much about you as you tell them about yourself. And that's because everything that the government industry or business knows about you is because you told them. You filled out a form, put the information on it, and gave it to them. And the Fourth Amendment protects you in your person, houses, papers, and effects, but it does not protect you from yourself. Now, can we have privacy in this computer age? The answer is, you bet we can. And that's because information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, it's knowing how this information is gathered, what information is stored, what information you want to keep personal and private, that actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Doesn't the FBI and the CIA and your local police department have privacy from you? How would you like to have that kind of privacy for yourself? Always keep in mind that no one knows anything about you that you haven't revealed by your own hand or mouth. Now, if you'd like to learn more about privacy and privacy issues and how to keep your affairs private, why don't you call and ask for my free general law CD package? Remember, that's a four-hour program. It's entertaining, informative, it's educational. Best of all, it's free of charge. And all you have to do to order yours is call the school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to the website at georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the Calamity Howler, the October 12th issue. Remember, the Calamity Howler comes free of charge. All you have to do is put in your name and address to AV Krebs. That's AVKREBS. AV Krebs at earthlink.net. All right, we're talking about the costs of the Iraq War. The Justice Department memo assuring the White House that torture was legal stands in stark violation of the International Convention Against Torture, of which the United States is a signatory. This, combined with the widely publicized mistreatment of Iraqi prisoners by U.S. military and intelligence officials, gave new license for torture and mistreatment by governments around the world. And the U.S. fired depleted uranium weapons have contributed to pollution of Iraq's land and water with inevitable spillover effects in other countries. The heavily polluted Tigris River, for example, flows through Iraq, Iran, and Kuwait. And the U.S.-led war and occupation have galvanized international terrorist organizations, placing people not only in Iraq but around the world at greater risk of attack. The State Department's annual report on international terrorism reported that in 2003 there was the highest level of terror-related incidents deemed significant than at any other time or any time since the U.S. began issuing these figures. Now, Sam Smith said that we owe an apology, and we're deeply moved by the comment by Richard Cheney to John Edwards during the recent debate concerning the relative contributions made by members of the coalition. Dick Cheney said that Edwards does not want to count the sacrifice and the contribution of Iraqi allies. It's their country. They're in the fight. They are increasingly the ones that are putting their necks on the line to take back their country from the terrorists and the old regime elements that are still left. You suggested somehow that they shouldn't count because you want to be able to say that the Americans are taking 90% of the sacrifice. You cannot succeed in this effort if you're not willing to recognize the enormous contribution that the Iraqis are increasingly making to their own future. We agree that not only has Edwards been deficient in this regard, but so have we all. We shall henceforth operate on the Cheney principle and count not just the casualties of America and its invading allies, but also those casualties of the Iraqi people, both military and civilian as well. And we trust other news media will follow suit, and that readers, out of respect towards the Vice President, will urge them to do so. The current count is as follows, using the lower estimates in case of conflicting calculations. American and coalition casualties, deaths, military and civilian, 19,000. Wounded, 47,000. Now, Ralph Nader got into the act the other day, and he said, Ralph Nader here now, made an explicit appeal on Monday for votes from the anti-war movement and called for the United States to announce a firm date for the withdrawal of its troops from Iraq. A sign the other day was on Letterman, I believe. And I think Letterman asked him, either him or Jay Leno, I forgot which, if he was taking votes away from the Democrats. And Nader had a pretty good response. I thought I'd share it with you. He said, "You may not agree with me, and you may not agree with my third-party candidacy, but it's third parties and third-party issues that become mainstream issues at some time in the future." And then he cited a bunch, like labor unions and a woman's right to vote, you know, in the United States. Those the woman's vote didn't come from Republicans or Democrats. It came from populists. And then it was forced on to the major parties, and the same thing will probably be true here of the Iraq War at some point in time. So when you vote for Nader, what you're saying to the other two parties, this is Nader now, is that we oppose the war and we're not going to vote for either one of you until you clean up or straighten up your act. So it's a protest vote against both major parties. Now, if, like Ross Perot, if enough people vote against the two major parties, then one party or the other will recognize that there's a constituency out there, and then they will move toward that constituency, like the Democrats have moved toward the abortion issue by supporting a woman's right to choose. And the Republicans have moved to the other side, and they say, well, we want right to life. So each one of these political parties will accept one or other of these constituencies. Of course, they'd like to get both of them, but, you know, the constituencies won't sit still for that. So Nader, running for president as an independent, said that President Bush was a messianic militarist and that Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts, the probable Democratic presidential nominee, was stuck in the Iraq quagmire the way Bush is. And he suggested that perhaps the withdrawal date should be 6 months from now. Merely announcing a date, certainly said, would separate the mainstream Iraqis from the insurgents. Scott Stanzel, a spokesman for the Bush campaign, said, "This kind of rhetoric is at odds with our nation's need for strong, steady leadership." Well, I'll let you decide. Election's up now in a couple of weeks, so you can go out and vote and decide who you want. All right, you've been listening to The Law Hour. I'm about out of time here. The editorial review is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, just go to the website at georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date. All right, there's the signal. It says my time's up. I got to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.